This show furnished by Dual Diagnosis Treatment Center.
Welcome to In Your Right Mind, a weekly discussion of behavioral health issues that affect our lives. We all have issues, so let's start talking. Good evening, and thank you for joining us on In Your Right Mind. My name is Christina Kushner.
And I'm Dr. Tanmoy Sharma.
Before we begin today's show, I want to ask, how many people have you known suffered from depression? For me, I can count a handful of people that have either sought medical treatment, whether they were hospitalized, or needed to talk to a doctor. What about you, Dr. Sharma?
Well, when I was practicing as a psychiatrist, I saw a large number of people with depression. But depression is colored by many situational things and also has a lot of comorbidity, as we will hear from our guest today.
Yeah, major depression is one of the most common mental illnesses. It affects more than 6% of American adults each year. The National Health and Nutrition Examination survey data showed 20% of Americans reported significant depressive symptoms, and more than 36% of who received no treatment from a mental health care professional. It is a mental disorder that can complicate medical conditions and can even be serious enough to lead to suicide. Dr. Sharma, at Sovereign Health, you treat depression. So how often do providers at your facilities treat people with this illness?
It's a very common illness. I think Dr. Joseph, who you have as a guest on the show, will be able to talk more about it. But it leads to significant morbidity. And as you know, the outcome can be quite fatal if left untreated.
Yeah, some even blame as several everyday factors, such as society becoming busier than ever and technology altering the way people relate to one another. However, depression is much more complex than some would think. To discuss, we are joined on the line with Dr. Nancy Joseph, as Dr. Sharma mentioned. Dr. Nancy Joseph is a licensed psychologist. She has trained at the Boston University Center for Anxiety and Related Disorders, the Boston Veterans Affairs Hospital, and McLean Hospital. She currently serves as the site training director at Sovereign Health of San Clemente.
We also have Dr. J. Anderson Thompson on the phone. Dr. Thompson is a psychiatrist in private practice in Charlottesville, Virginia. He's also a staff psychiatrist at the Counseling and Psychological Services at the University of Virginia Student Health Services and the Institute of Law, Psychiatry, and Public Policy at the University of Virginia. Thank you both for being here.
Now, Dr. Thompson and Dr. Joseph, earlier we read the statistic of how many American adults are impacted by depression. Now, that's a startling number. Dr. Thompson, do you believe depression has become more common in society?
I think the statistics indicate that it has.
Dr. Thompson, this is Dr. Sharma. It would be important for our audience to get your perspective on the evolutionary nature of depression. And you had put forward your stance along with your co-author that that depression is almost a necessity in terms of our evolution and our livelihood. So perhaps you could elaborate on that a little bit.
Well, I've had the privilege of working with Paul Andrews, a psychologist at McMaster University, and this really is largely his work. And I would, any of the listeners that are interested, I would encourage them to look him up and his work, Paul Andrews, Psychology, McMaster's University. And he's one of several researchers who approach depression from an evolutionary point of view, meaning that the basic structure of depression is something that was designed. It's not an illness per se, at least the basics of depression. I mean, depression can get extreme, and I think, no question, become an illness. But you mentioned earlier just the number of people who have depression. And if we step back and think about it, natural selection, evolution, wouldn't design us to have something that is really a disorder or a breakdown, particularly in the period of time, peak reproductive years. That doesn't make sense. And so one view here is that depression, the basics of depression, is an evolved function. Even though it's miserable, just like pain is an involved function. Pain tells us we've got a problem. Physical pain tells us we've got a problem, tells us how severe it is, tells us where it's located. It's functional. And one way of thinking about depression is that it, too, is functional. Even though it's miserable, it's designed to serve a purpose and to tell us we've got a problem, tell us how severe the problem is, help us focus on the problem until we alleviate it. And that's the basic idea here.
But pain has a protective factor that, you know, it shows either because you touch something hot or there is pain and an immediate withdrawal reflex, or you have pain and it's a symptom of something else that has gone awry. Would you place depression in that same category?
I think like you, I'm a psychiatrist who was trained in a traditional viewpoint, and this is a different viewpoint. But I think your questions illustrate exactly those issues. I would argue that depression has a protective function. We know that depression will hit when people keep trying to pursue unreachable goals. It's almost like the mind will step in and say, enough already, and back us down, even in some sense against our will, and force us to reassess an unreachable goal. So I think it can have a protective function. Also, the second point that you raised is that pain tells us that there is a problem, and we go looking for the problem. And I think this is one area that we have really not thought through using our medical education. Like you, I was trained as a physician, and when somebody has pain, we go looking for the cause. Somebody has a fever, we go looking for the source of that fever. And I think what we have done is take depression and separate it from its potential causes. It would be like a patient comes to us and they've got pain, and all we do is give them a painkiller. We don't go looking for the source of the pain. And one of you mentioned in the introduction that depression is associated with situational factors. That, I think, is the key, that we know that depression is triggered by stress, mm-hmm. and that when we have a depressed patient, I think what we want to do is we want to go and look for what is causing that depression. What is the interpersonal, the social conflict that is causing or triggering that depression? Not just to treat the symptom, but to go after the cause. And I think in psychiatry, we've moved a little bit too much to separating depression from its causes and treating it as an entity in and of itself and just, say, giving medications. If a patient came in with pain in his leg, you and I wouldn't, just give them a painkiller. We'd be trying to find out what's wrong with their leg that they've got the pain.
Yes, and depressed people often think intensely about their problems. These thoughts, as we know, are called ruminations. They're persistent, mm-hmm. and depressed people have difficulty thinking about anything else. And we also know that numerous studies have shown that this thinking style is often highly analytical. Mm-hmm. They dwell on a complex problem, breaking it down into smaller components, which are considered one at a time. And so it is possible then this analytical style of thought can be very productive.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So,
I think that's largely the some of the beauty of Paul's work is that I think he's shown that, we had previously looked at something that like ruminations and thought the ruminations and brooding were bad, and I think the evidence is to the contrary that. The ruminations, as you mentioned, are the first part of it is we're trying to sort out exactly what the problem or problems are, and we're using analytic reasoning, we're breaking it down into small components, we're trying to figure out what the problem is, and then once we've mapped out the problem, then we shift to trying to solve the problem. And depression, I think the evidence, and this is what has changed my mind, I think the evidence supports the idea that depression, as painful as it is at times, motivates us to focus on the problems, even if we don't want to look at them, and to try to solve them.
And it looks like in terms of the evidence, there is some research that, and there is evidence for the fact that people who get more depressed whilst they are working on complex problems, like in an intelligence test, tended to score higher on that test.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And to me, one of the interesting things about this is that it makes sense of some things that were discovered long before the evolutionary view of depression started to be utilized. I mean, we've known for a long time that people who are depressed have what is called depressive realism. They make better assessments of themselves, better assessment of other people. That if you're a little bit depressed, your reality testing is better. And we've known that for a long time.
Right. And the opposite is true in the sense of having a, you know, if you are slightly high, you can do a lot of things but make wrong decisions because of your over-enthusiasm. I'm being summoned by Christina to go into a commercial break. But when we come back, I'd like to talk to you about the ventrolateral, you know, prefrontal cortex and what you feel are the neural correlates of depression. There have been many studies, and we've done some in my research group many years ago, looking at anhedonia, for example, the lack of ability to feel any pleasure. Dr. Kumari and I have published extensively on that. But let's look at this in the context of the prefrontal cortex.
Well, you're listening to In Your Right Mind on Talk Radio 790 KABC. Are you or a loved one suffering from an eating disorder? At Sovereign Health, we believe these are brain diseases that can strain people's lives, which should not define them. Let us help you heal in a safe, nurturing environment with an individualized treatment plan that has your unique qualities and meets your treatment needs. Call Sovereign Health at 866-764-6570. That's 866-764-6570. Or visit us online at sovhealth.com.
Previously on The Drive Home.
Alexa, make sure the Kings win tonight. I have that, Alexa. The kids love asking it questions. Although they started asking it questions about me one night.
Uh-oh.
Alexa, tell us about Jillian Barbary. Jillian Barbary is a Canadian / host / actress / And I was like, okay, let's turn it off now, kids. I don't know what else she's going to say about me. Yeah. We were over at a friend's house. And it was all the kids that I was like, what? What is that thing? And then she gave me one as a gift, my friend Renee. And I love it. I said, Alexa, I want to go shopping. All right. What would you like? I would like some Tide. And then Tide was delivered to my house 2 days later. I'm not kidding. But
that's dangerous.
That's what I'm starting to hear, that they are listening, and well, they ain't going to hear much at my house. A couple kids running around, one playing the drums, one screaming about her Barbies. Listen in. Me not having sex? Go ahead. Me trying to cook a dinner and cursing at the oven because I burnt it again? If that's what you call entertainment, have fun.
Would they hear you listening to any of the Lifetime Television for Women movies? Or is that just at my house?
No. I listen, I don't watch the Lifetime because those are reenactments, but I'm a documentary. I just finished a documentary on the Slender Girl killers. And, well, they didn't kill the girl, but these two 12-year-old girls lured their friend into the woods, another 12-year-old little girl, after a sleepover. And they had premeditated it, and they stabbed and stabbed, and this poor child crawled out. They thought they had killed her. She crawled out, and a good Samaritan on a bike got her. And she's completely mentally, as you can imagine, for the rest of her life. And guess what? In the state where this happened, they're trying them as adults.
There we go.
They're 12 years old. I'm all for it.
The Drive Home with Jillian Barbary and John Phillips.
Weekdays 3 to 6
on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
I'm good, but I have a story, and I don't know where to start.
When the veteran in your life says,
I'm good.
Are they really?
I'm really not so good, but are you ready to listen?
Suicide prevention is everyone's responsibility. Listen to the veteran or service member in your life. Learn more at veteranscrisisline.net.
Talk Radio 790.
KABC.
Welcome back to In Your Right Mind on Talk Radio 790 KABC. Today's show focuses on depression, its purpose, and evolution. To discuss on the line, we have Dr. J. Anderson Thompson and Dr. Nancy Joseph.
Dr. Thompson, before the break, we were talking about what are the brain underpinnings of depression, and we felt that you might want to talk about it in a broader context, so go ahead.
Certainly. Thank you. I think one of the ways to understand this is that if depression were an illness, then you would have a normally functioning system that is broken. So imagine a leg which is broken. That's clearly not an adaptation. A leg which is crucial is broken. It's damaged. I know your research has been in schizophrenia. I don't think that's adaptive. I think schizophrenia is a broken brain. Normal systems are not there and disrupted. What is interesting about depression is that it does not appear as if it's a broken brain. The systems that seem to be mapped out in depression make for a functional system at every level. It's sort of like the eye. The eye is not a broken system. The eye is an exquisitely designed feature of our bodies. And this analogy is one of Paul Anders, and I think it's excellent. So you see that the eye is functional. It sees, and all its mechanisms fall into that function. And if we look at what happens with depression, you see, I think, the same, if you look at how it is mapped out, all of the things that go into depression seem to be by design, so that when we get depressed, we focus our attention on the problem. You mentioned anhedonia. We can't feel pleasure. Depression reduces distraction. Depression has us, you know, stop business as usual and focus on our problem. We increase REM sleep, which is part of processing. The area of the brain that you asked me about, the ventrolateral prefrontal cortex, that seems to light up. That starts to consume a lot of energy. That's the area of the brain that's involved in analytic reasoning. The other thing that lights up in the brain is what's called the default network. When our brains are just quietly at rest, the default network lights up, and that's a network that is used in thinking about our personal relationships, our social situation. And it's usually personal relationships and social situations that trigger depression. So the areas of the brain that light up are the ones that are trying to problem solve, and particularly problem solve in relationships. So that at the level of the anatomy of the brain, you see design. Let's take it, you know, another step down. The stress of depression creates insulin resistance, increased blood sugar levels, and particularly increased blood sugar levels to the brain. The brain's having to work harder. It needs more fuel, and you see that shift of fuel to the brain with depression. Again, that doesn't sound like something broken. That sounds like by design. The myth out there is that depression is a low serotonin phenomena. I think the evidence is overwhelming that it's actually a high serotonin phenomena at the parts of the brain that we're talking about, because serotonin controls energy production. Serotonin increases calcium, transported into the mitochondria, which are the energy factories, creating ATP for energy that the brain needs to utilize. Serotonin enhances use of lactate, anaerobic metabolism, again in the areas of the brain for problem solving. And energy production can sometimes create reactive oxygen species in the brain, which are are not good. This is why we all take antioxidants to try to reduce the damage of reactive oxygen species in our brain. And what does serotonin do? Serotonin is an antioxidant. So one of the arguments here is that if you look at everything that goes on with depression, from behavior to thoughts to ruminations, the kind of ruminations, to the areas of the brain, to the neurotransmitters and hormones involved in depression, it doesn't look like something that is broken or an illness. It actually has the qualities of design. And that's one of the things I think that suggests that the basis of depression is an adaptation, is an evolved, designed function, just like pain and fever. Even though they're painful, they're functional, they're designed by evolution to deal with certain problems.
So in going back to two things, one is the ventrolateral prefrontal cortex. I know we skipped over that part, but I think it's an important piece where this is the area of the brain where you have the neurons or the nerve cells that need to be continuously firing for people mm-hmm. to avoid getting distracted. And so if it continuously fires and there's a lot of energy that's required, it's like, you know, I think you likened it to a car's engine eating up fuel when going up a mm-hmm. mountain road. And this continuous firing causes the neurons to break down. So it's almost as if there is too much activity that is going on, and then this whole system shuts down. So to prevent that from happening, we are kind of protecting that area of the brain so that you don't have to be as distracted. And also, you mentioned serotonin. I guess the receptor, the 5-HT1A receptor, is involved in supplying these nerve cells or neurons with the fuel that they need to fire. So again, there is this whole, how do we tie that all in? The isolation.
Well, as I said, I'm summarizing it. I think, again, and it suggests that that's evidence for design. I would say that's not evidence for malfunction.
Right. One thing that you raised that people might wonder about is that, well, you know, drugs like fluoxetine or Prozac people are very familiar with, it increases the level of serotonin. And yet you mentioned that this might be a disorder of increased serotonin. So that seems to be at odds with what normally people would think of in depression.
Yes, and I think it is complicated. And again, I can only refer listeners who are interested to some of the papers on this. You increase with Prozac and the serotonin boosting drugs, you increase serotonin at the level of the brainstem. But the evidence suggests that what then happens is you actually lower serotonin activity in the areas of the brain that are doing analytic reasoning. So that the drugs actually promote serotonin activity at one area of the brain, but it reduces serotonin activity at the area of the brain where you're trying to do the hard work, the analytic reasoning.
Right, right. And there's also evidence, it seems, that the people who are in these, you know, depressed mood states, not severe depression, but they seem to be better at solving social dilemmas as well.
Yes. Yeah, you can't. I work at a student health service. When you're depressed, people say, well, I can't concentrate. Well, that's right. You can't do your accounting homework. You can't write that political science paper because you're preoccupied with the breakup with the person you were deeply in love with and trying to sort out what happened, how did that happen, how am I going to recover?
So actually, I want to ask Dr. Joseph a question about even the symptoms of depression. Can you explain to us just the symptoms, both from a psychological and biological standpoint?
Sure, I'd be happy to. I think this discussion, though, is really intriguing about depression not being a broken system, but a functioning one. Because when you look at the symptoms themselves, like things such as, as Dr. Thompson already mentioned, having this diminished ability to think or concentrate or indecisiveness. Is it really a diminished ability to think, or rather a hyper-focus on, some of these situations that they're perceiving? Also, perhaps even having this depressed mood where they are fatigued and, you know, probably experiencing hypersomnia. Like, perhaps that's a part of this as well. But it is interesting, though, because when I think about even some of the original theories to help us understand why depression may develop, it does speak a little bit to some adaptive function. Like, I think about Seligman's work with research on dogs, not humans. But the main point of that theory was that when people encounter difficult situations, which they can't control, they might give up on trying to change those situations or trying to escape. So in the face of these uncontrollable negative events, these individuals might feel helpless to change and might develop these symptoms that we see in depression, this kind of passive response to negative situations. But that theory didn't really explain why some individuals develop depression and others don't. But there is some aspect of it that would seem to suggest that there's some maybe perhaps an adaptive function that's playing out. However, there was a reformulated approach for that learned helplessness theory done by Abramson and his colleagues, where they further refined Seligman's theory on research on humans, and they really further emphasized the role of these incorrect attributional styles. So once again, it's not really speaking to whether this is a disorder or not, but rather attributional styles that may arise from situations that one may experience, and as a result, develop schemas and ways of viewing them in a way that they will allow them to, you know, continue to function in those situations. But maybe I can not use the word incorrect, but more so maladaptive, because when you find that individuals who are experiencing negative events that they might perceive as uncontrollable, if they possess more of this depressogenic attributional style, you'll find that they have more of these stable, global, and internal attributions that can result in symptoms of helplessness and even hopelessness. And it's really that idea of this depressogenic attributional style contributing to why some individuals, in the face of these negative situations that seem uncontrollable, go on to develop depression while others do not. But I think it is an interesting question or a topic that's being discussed here. But as I mentioned, you know, the depressed mood, the anhedonia, as was already mentioned, also significant weight loss without intentional dieting or significant weight gain. And then, as I mentioned, insomnia or hypersomnia, individual might experience psychomotor agitation or retardation. So it isn't always the case that a person is just feeling physically, subjectively slowed. And then also feelings of worthlessness and even thoughts of death, and maybe perhaps even attempts at a suicide. But those are all aspects that you may see in someone who's presenting with depression.
Well, we're actually going to just take another quick break, but when we come back, we'll look into whether depression has a purpose even more so. You're listening to In Your Right Mind on Talk Radio 790 KABC. Nearly half of all Americans experience at least one mental illness at some point in their lives. Sovereign Health offers treatment programs for a large spectrum of issues, including depression, anxiety, bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, post-traumatic stress disorder, and eating disorders. Let us help you heal in a safe, nurturing environment with an individualized treatment plan that has your unique qualities and meets your treatment needs. Call Sovereign Health at 866-764-6570. That's 866-764-6570. Or visit us online at sovhealth.com.
Uh-oh. Speaking of problems.
It's Peter Tilden. On the next Peter Tilden at 10, we'll talk about the House and Senate investigations into Russia meddling. Arkansas can't find enough folks to witness executions, and if you're over 60, you are drinking more. Let me know if you need help. Talk Radio 790 KBC. See you here at 10.
Hey, this is Dr. Drew.
And I'm Mike Catherwood. Keep going, Drew.
Be careful, Mike. Be careful.
I know. I'm sorry.
Wait. Start over. Hey, this is Dr. Drew.
I know I sound a little out of it, but I have a steel rod poking through my body.
Is that a trident in your neck? Start over.
Take three. We talked about what you're supposed to say. You didn't say what we talked about.
Okay, here we go. Take three. How many steel rods do you have in you?
No, you're supposed to go, well, yeah, but you're nothing. This guy has four.
Oh, you're nothing. This guy has four, but you're dead too, though. What difference? All right, that and more on the next Midday Live with Dr. Mike Catherwood, Talk Radio 790 KBC. Kick it!
This is Nnamdi Asamoah. I play football for the Philadelphia Eagles, but what I do off the field with United Way might be more important. I'm a volunteer tutor and mentor. Why? Because over a million kids a year drop out of school, and that's not okay. It takes 12 years to create a graduate, but it takes about the same time to create a dropout. And the difference between a child becoming one or the other could be me, or it could be you. Studies show that if we get to these kids earlier, their chances are better. And kids who read well by third grade are more likely to graduate. So join me in United Way. Suit up and take the pledge. Become a volunteer reader, tutor, or mentor. Because when a child succeeds, we all succeed. Give. Advocate. Volunteer. Live United. Take the pledge at unitedway.org. Brought to you by United Way, the Ad Council, and the National Football League.
You're going to need me.
You're going to need us.
All of us.
You're going to need our help with your water, your air, your food.
You're going to need our determination, our compassion.
You're going to need the next generation of leaders to face the challenges the future will bring.
And we promise we'll be there when you need us.
Today, 4-H is growing the next generation of leaders. Support us at 4-H.org.
Welcome back to In Your Right Mind on Talk Radio 790 KABC. We've been discussing depression based on research between 30 to 50% of the U.S. and other countries have met current psychiatric diagnostic criteria for major depressive disorder sometime in their lives. With this illness being as common as it is, one might be asking if there's a purpose behind it. To discuss, we have Dr. J. Anderson Thompson and Dr. Nancy Joseph on the line.
Dr. Thompson, we were discussing maybe the evolutionary purpose of depression. If one takes a more skeptical view, as I'm sure you've had to deal with when you've talked about this along with your colleague, that, you know, depression is a deadly illness. It can be fatal, and it leads to lack of self-care. There are problems with patients who are depressed. Does this then, you know, negate the benefits of it? So there might be some help in problem-solving skills, but there's reduction in investment in childcare. There, some people don't groom, bathe, or even use the toilet. So are we talking about a milder side of depression that is beneficial rather than the entire spectrum? I want our listeners to, you know, I don't want to leave them with a view that depression is good in general and may not need treatment. Mm-hmm. So
I think that's an excellent question, and you're absolutely right. I'm not saying there's, you know, that this is not to be taken seriously or that it's good. We're talking about the utility of depression, the utility of depression's basic design, maybe. But I think, again, to use the, you know, some of the medical analogies, all of us know that fever can run out of control. People can have high fevers, have seizures. We know, so there's something that adaptive that can get out of control. We know that pain, people with pain, the pain can get out of control, and people can develop pain syndromes that just take on a life of their own, radiculopathies. And I think we have to be on guard for those depressions that become severe and life-threatening. Depression, and I think you're right. We have to maintain a skeptical view of all of this until there's more evidence. But I think there's accumulating evidence that even major depression, even, you know, meeting the DSM criteria, its original purpose was functional. And there's a study in Germany that showed even hospitalized depressed patients did better on analytic reasoning tasks than controls who weren't depressed, and better than those depressed hospitalized patients that were better, that had been treated and were better. So even in severe depression, it can be functional. It doesn't mean you don't try to help the individual, identify their problems, solve the problems. If they're not eating, not bathing, if it's getting severe, absolutely, I still aggressively treat those people. But it's just a different, I think, a different way of thinking about it that I have found useful. And, you know, I changed my view. I was trained like you in the traditional view of severe depression as purely an illness. And I think this new view has a lot of usefulness. I'm a practicing clinician. I'm not a researcher. And that which helps my patients is what I gravitate towards.
Well, we'll come. I have a thing that ties in ruminations with treatment, but that's, we'll leave that to the next segment. Social isolation is something.
If I may just add one thing, yeah. If people think about grief.
Right.
I mean, grief, severe grief, I don't think anybody would say is a disease.
No.
I mean, it's a normal, awful part of life.
Right.
But grief helps us move towards solving the problems of the loss.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, you can think about severe depression as, you know, just like severe grief.
Mm. Right, right. So the analogies are there, but we need treatment, and there, I don't think there is any, there's anything that we're saying that is not out of the ordinary. We're looking at this as an adaptive mechanism rather than a broken one.
Yes.
So.
Well, but it can get broken. I think that's the problem we have is that, I mean, clearly there are people who the depression spins out of control, and it's not adaptive. It's mm-hmm. malfunctioning, and it's dangerous, and it's not adaptive at all.
So that's what I was referring to, really, and in terms of a continuum, that it's, if you like, this is an inverted, it's like a bell-shaped curve or inverted U, that there is some benefit as you go up, and then at one point there comes a tipping point whereby this becomes destructive, if you like, for people.
I think that's a useful way of looking at it.
Yeah.
I think part of what I would now argue is that our profession has defined that tipping point a little bit too far to the left, that we will, you know, somebody comes in who's depressed and we'll just give them an antidepressant and we won't pursue what's making them depressed. What are the problems? What's driving the depression? Trying to help them identify the problems and help them solve those problems.
Right.
I think that we may actually not be helping them. I can just give you one example. I had, and this is a woman patient I had some years ago before I learned about the evolutionary view, and she said, the antidepressant is really helping. I feel a whole lot better, but I'm still married to the same abusive alcoholic husband.
Mm. Right. So the social circumstances.
I was worried that I had made her feel better with the antidepressant, but it had maybe blunted her ability to solve the problem and to extract herself from a very bad marriage.
Mm. Right. We also have the situation where I remember when I was, you know, back in Hopkins in the early 90s, and we had Kay Jamison, who's pretty well known as a professor of psychiatry at Johns Hopkins.
One of my heroes.
Right, 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 and mine too. So talked about, you know, showed in some research as well as some literature reviews that successful individuals were 8 times as likely as people in the general population to suffer from major depressive illness. So it looks like there is some, you know, we have seen that with bipolar disorder, or at least the high side of bipolar disorder, that people are gregarious, outgoing, making those decisions and entrepreneurial, etc. But in terms of analytic and success, it seems that depression does have the creative aspects as well. Mm-hmm. It's not just, you know, a Van Gogh type of, you know, you have to be really out of it to do your creative pieces.
That pain.
most.
Yeah. And feel the pain. I think a lot of people who have been very creative have been through quite a lot of painful processes. So, Dr. Joseph, in the patients that are seen across the country at Sovereign Health, maybe you can give us some idea as to what severity of illness do you come across?
In terms of depression, it is rarely presenting in its pure form. There really is someone coming into a clinic who's simply depressed. Oftentimes, it is comorbid, as you mentioned earlier, with other disorders. In fact, all forms of non-mood disorders are, exacerbated by the presence of depression and can sometimes be accompanied by them. So we definitely see much more diagnostic complexity in one's presentation when it comes to coming to a clinic and dealing with depression. There's oftentimes other issues there that might be the reason why the depression is there, such as if they're dealing with substance use disorders or, personality disorders and the like.
Sometimes I wonder about the futility of us treating depression. Dr. Thompson mentioned something. I remembered a patient of mine a long time ago when I was also treating her depression with serotonin uptake inhibitors or SSRIs like Prozac. And she had 3 kids under the age of 5, a marriage that just wasn't working, and lived in what in the UK is known as council accommodation. This is, Section 8 type of housing. And I was thinking, I can load her up with IV Prozac if I want to, but the circumstances don't change. And so unless we can empower people to deal with the circle, in this case, I had her work with a social worker. But if it's an abusive relationship or if something else is triggering the depression, I don't know if you're just propping people up with treatment, whether it's pharmacology or psychopharmacology or psychological therapies. I don't know whether there is, maybe this is a vexed question that doesn't have an answer, but I'd still like to get your input. Go ahead, Dr. Thompson. Go ahead.
Sure. My analogy here would be like somebody who comes into the emergency room with severe abdominal pain.
Right.
We don't give that individual painkillers and then send them on their way. We try to find out what's causing that severe abdominal pain. We work them up. We evaluate them. We try to sort out what is triggering the distress. And I think your patient is an example of that. In other words, this woman is severely depressed, and you know some things that may be driving her depression. She's poor. She's in an abusive marriage. She's got 3 kids under the age of 5. So you know that there's some problems there, and I think what this view of depression tells us is, okay, let's try to map out as best we can what are the problems that are driving this woman's depression, and what are the things that are most distressing to her that she's trying to sort out and sort out how to deal with, And to go after the source of the problems, the source of the depression, the origins of the pain. And I think that's what this view helps reorient the mental health profession towards. Let's go for what's causing the abdominal pain. But I want to be clear here. Let's say this woman is just, the depression has reached a level where, she can't function and she can't work on her problems. Then I think you do have to consider antidepressants. I mean, I think antidepressants still have a role, but they may not be as first line of treatment as we have thought.
Well, we're actually going to just take another quick break, but in our concluding segment with Dr. Joseph and Dr. Thompson, we'll discuss more regarding treatment for depression. You're listening to In Your Right Mind on Talk Radio 790 KABC. Want to get the latest information regarding mental illnesses, substance abuse, or more? Get hooked on Hook Sober, a group of sobers who have been hooked on updating you with the latest trends regarding behavioral health and addiction. Want to check them out? Just go to hooksober.com. That's HOOKEDSOBER.com. And get hooked, because recovery is possible in all cases.
Wake up with Doug McIntyre in the morning.
There's a film called Raw. It's a French film by Julia Tournier.
Perfect.
What was that again?
Julia Tournier. Nailed it.
That was great.
Thank you. And it is about cannibalism.
No, thanks.
And they're handing out barf bags with every ticket purchase. I don't necessarily need to see that. If I want to see something disgusting, I could just go into the men's room here at KBC.
McIntyre in the morning. Now with Leanne Tweeden News. 5 to 10 on KABC.
Now you can take the NBC4 News at 6 with you in your car.
Whoa, whoa, whoa. What?
KABC is now simulcasting the NBC4 News at 6.
So if they're the news in News Talk Evolved, what does that make us?
You have to tune in to find out. Dr. Doom, Mike Catherine, noon to 3 on 790 KABC.
My name is Ruth Roosie. I'm a retired teacher. I'm 91 years old, and this is how I live United. I say retired, but not really. Once a week, I read books to children as part of United Way's education program. Reading to a child creates links between language and literacy. It creates a bond between grown-up and child. And believe it or not, it prepares them for a better academic future. Oh, we read about frogs and flies and pigs with wings, all sorts of juicy stuff. It's a joy to watch all those little faces. I figure I have the time and they have the need. And I've always believed that if we're not here to help each other, then what are we here for really? My name is Ruth Roosie. I help kids prepare to succeed in school. So I don't just wear the shirt, I live it.
Give, advocate, volunteer, live United. Go to liveunited.org, brought to you by United Way and the Ad Council.
Get clarity on the things that make you go. Live and local, KABC.
Welcome back to In Your Right Mind on Talk Radio 790 KABC. Today's show hits home for many listeners, including us here. We're talking about depression, what it is, its purpose, and what areas of the brain are involved. To discuss, we have Dr. J. Anderson Thompson and Dr. Nancy Joseph.
Dr. Joseph, in terms of the treatment for depression, we've heard about the psychopharmacological side of it. Tell us a little bit about the psychological therapies that are used within Sovereign Health to treat depression and its comorbidities.
Certainly. There are a number of psychological treatments for depression that are available. The one that I can talk a bit more about today is cognitive behavior therapy. It's considered an efficacious treatment for depression as well as other anxiety disorders. And it was created by Aaron Beck with an approach of helping individuals identify cognitive distortions they may engage in that might influence their mood and their behaviors. And the goal of CBT is really to restructure those cognitions in order to see a resulting change in one's mood as well as their behaviors. There are a number of approaches that one can use within CBT to, achieve that effect. But the goal is to really understand, what are the issues that bring a patient to treatment and really explore how one's way of viewing themselves, viewing the world, may be playing a role in the maintenance of those symptoms.
And so these are some of these cognitive distortions that are there that CBT or cognitive behavior therapy tries to improve or change?
Correct. Yeah. So, for the most part, CBT is a very present-oriented treatment. It focuses quite a bit on the thoughts that one is having in the present day, as well as the automatic thoughts that might be generated as they face different situations. But in its formulation in their book, Judith Beck talks about the importance of really exploring the core beliefs that one holds that may be generated from as early as their childhood that might influence, the ways in which they're responding to negative situations that arise in their present day. And some of those core beliefs might be things such as I'm unlovable or I'm not good enough and so forth. And that can really contribute to certain conditional assumptions and beliefs that can then be, you know, maintained. So in the future, when someone does encounter a negative experience that they may have much more difficulty in addressing, we can sometimes see that these distortions become more problematic for the individual.
Oh, okay. So, Dr. Thompson, how do we reconcile the issue of ruminations with this? It almost seems like CBT is anti-rumination, if you like. Is there a way of reconciling the two?
Well, I'm not an expert on that. And I think, clearly CBT works.
Right.
My understanding of the research is that it may not be the cognitive distortion correction part of it, but I think there's some research that shows that what may be the crucial part of CBT is the behavioral activation part. But again, and that would, you know, suggest people moving towards solving their problems. But, you know, I'm right. not an expert on
sure.
that.
Well, it looks like depression doesn't appear out of nowhere. It's typically a response to an adversity, with up to 80% of cases following major life events.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, is a clue that it's a response. It's painful, but it's a designed response. Just like if I have a fish hook in my hand, one would hope it would hurt, because if it didn't hurt, that would actually be more dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
And if I had major life events, if I got fired from my job and my wife abandoned me, you would hope I would respond. I would react and stop business as usual and get sad and get focused on how am I going to cope with this.
Dr. Thompson and Dr. Joseph, we've unfortunately run out of time. But if you'd like to hear more from our guest speakers, please go to www.inyourrightmind.com and click on the guest Q&A tab. Next week on In Your Right Mind, we talk about the disease of being busy. Our society is wrapped up in the idea of busyness being a badge of honor. However, is it more harmful than helpful? And how can one be more mindful? That's next Sunday on In Your Right Mind on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Good night and take care.
Roughly 100 million Americans suffer from chronic pain. This problem is not only excruciating, but it also takes a hit on the individual's relationships with others. Here at Sovereign Health's Chronic Pain Program, our experts target and treat the underlying causes of the problem, while also helping our patients discover the best pain reduction methods that work for them. Let us help you heal. Call Sovereign Health at 866-764-6570. That's 866-764-6570. Or visit us online at sovhealth.com. Don't lose sight on finding the best help for your son or daughter.
It was impossible, it seemed, to have him at home. We didn't know what to do. We were at a loss.
Sovereign Health's adolescent program offers treatment for males and females of ages 12 through 17 struggling with addiction, mental health, and co-occurring conditions.
Someone recommended Sovereign Health. We went down there and met the people, and that's what really did it for me. Everybody there seemed really not just kind. They didn't seem like they were there just punching the clock. They seemed like they were really caring about him. They cared about the dilemma that we were in.
Let us help you and your family heal in a safe, nurturing environment with an individualized treatment plan that has unique qualities and meets your loved one's treatment needs. Call Sovereign Health at 866-224-7297. That's 866-224-7297. Or visit us online at sovhealth.com.
This show furnished by Dual Diagnosis Treatment Center.
On average, Angelinos spend an additional 80 hours a year behind the wheel due to traffic.
And while we can't help you recoup that time, we can help you pass the time by covering the stories that impact you in a smart, clever, and sometimes hilarious way. Think of us as The Daily Show. Only hourly. KABC. Los Angeles. Orange County. Accumulate.